Since no one answered, I'm going to assume that we're on slide 13. And recall from last time that we are going over the major kinds of chemical bonds. We talked about ionic bonds and we ended talking about covalent bonds. Slide 13 shows you the formation of covalent bonds represented with Lewis dot diagrams. And remember that a Lewis dot diagram features a symbol for the element, for that atom's element in the middle representing the nucleus, and only valence electrons are indicated with dots. You never draw the non-valence electrons. Well, for hydrogen, there's only one electron, and it's a valence electron, of course, so there's one dot. But that single dot, in terms of orbitals, is a half-filled orbital, right? Because an orbital can hold two. And that's why it's more stable if hydrogen gets credit for another electron, because that single orbital is the only orbital in the entire first shell. That will satisfy hydrogen. It'll make it just as happy as neon, number two on the periodic table. That's why they make the deal. But the important point by drawing it this way is to remind you of something I've already told you. A single covalent bond is never one electron. It's always a pair of electrons, because each of the two atoms involved shares one with the other. So there are two that are being shared in a single bond, which you can represent by two dots, as you see here, or as a dash, as we've been talking about in lab. For oxygen, same thing, except oxygen's valence electrons are in the second shell, right? Oxygen has eight total electrons because it's element eight. So it has eight protons, and to be neutral, it has eight electrons. Two of those fill the first shell. That means six of them are in the valence shell. And therefore, the valence of oxygen is what? Two. It needs two more to get to eight, which is the total that shell two can hold. And when you look at its Lewis dot diagram, doesn't show you eight dots. That's what I was saying earlier, because you only put dots for valence electrons. The valence shell is the only one that's going to interact with other things to form bonds. That's why we don't bother with the non-valence electrons in a Lewis dot diagram. And the four sides of the oxygen, since oxygen's valence shell is shell 2, and since shell 2 has four total orbitals in it, right? A single s, the 2s, and three different 2p orbitals, 2px, 2py, 2pz, for a total of four orbitals. You can think of the four sides of the oxygen in the dot diagram as the four orbitals. Two of those four orbitals are filled, and those pairs of dots, which represent the filled orbitals, those are going to stay the property of oxygen. They're not going to be shared. It's the ones that are half-filled that are going to be shared, so that by also receiving credit for the one that's being shared by the other atom, that orbital will effectively be filled, giving oxygen stability just like neon. But in this case, the valence is two, right, as we said. And you can think practically of the valence as being the number of bonds that that type of atom is going to have to make to be satisfied if it's part of a molecule. Oxygen's always going to be making two bonds. Well, if it's making a bond with another oxygen, they each need to make two bonds, and therefore they form a double covalent bond, which is four total electrons, as you see by the dots. And it counts as two bonds, even though it's a single, it's one double bond, it really counts as two bonds. And as you might have guessed, a double covalent bond is even stronger than a single covalent bond. Covalent bonds in general are much stronger already than ionic bonds, the other kind of chemical bond we talked about. Well, a double covalent bond is even harder to break than a single covalent bond. It's a stronger bond. And there are such things as triple covalent bonds, which happens in nitrogen. If you look at nitrogen, it has how many valence electrons? No. It has five valence electrons. It's five from the left in its period, right? It has a valence of three. It has five valence electrons. So its dot diagram is going to look like this, right? And another one will have the same dot diagram. Three of those orbitals need to be involved in sharing in order to satisfy each one. So it's possible for this kind of atom to form triple bonds with other atoms. And a triple bond is the strongest covalent bond. As a matter of fact, this has ecological importance to all living things because all living things vitally require nitrogen, since it's a component of all proteins and it's also a component of DNA. Can't have any DNA or proteins, and therefore no organisms without nitrogen. Every living thing vitally needs it. And ironically, it's all around us. Well, those of us who live in air, which is, we're examples of animals that live in air rather than in water, the vast majority of air is pure nitrogen. But we can't use any of that nitrogen, even though we'll die without nitrogen. And therefore, we rely, this is one of several reasons why we absolutely rely on certain bacteria, which are the only things that are capable of breaking this triple bond and turning nitrogen gas into usable forms of nitrogen, since that's such a strong bond. We can't exist without those bacteria, and neither can anything else. 14, just some more examples of ways in which we can symbolize these covalent bonds. You can do it with electron distribution diagrams right here, which are nice because it indicates the sharing. It's really just a combination of those circular shells we were talking about before. But this way you can see that some electrons are going to stay with an atom, the unshared ones, and some of them are going to spend time around both of the two nuclei. Once you get the concept down, though, you don't really have to draw those out every time. It's the space-filling model. Those are nice because we can do it with a computer. They're nice pictures, but they don't really give you much information. The Lewis dot diagram reminds you, though, that each bond is actually two electrons. All right, now to 15. This is a water molecule, and water has special properties. A lot of special properties that an entire chapter is devoted to in the next chapter. But it's shown here not because of water particularly, but because it's introducing the notion of polarity. Now, we've talked about ionic bonds. We've talked about covalent bonds, right? Those are the two major kinds of chemical bonds. And why are they chemical bonds?
They create something new in you?
Right. Formation of chemical bonds changes the stuff that you have. It changes the substance. And that's not true of all bonds, but it's true of chemical bonds. But anyway, that's the two major types, ionic and covalent. Well, once you realize that you don't have an ionic bond, but you have a covalent bond, then you can break down that category into two subcategories, which are polar covalent bonds and nonpolar covalent bonds. And therefore, or correspondingly, molecules can be classified as either polar or nonpolar, depending on whether they contain polar covalent bonds. Not all molecules, by definition of being molecules, have covalent bonds, right? We've talked about that before. But not every molecule is polar, because some molecules have only nonpolar covalent bonds. Therefore, we need to distinguish between a nonpolar covalent bond and a polar covalent bond. Well, all covalent bonds, by definition, involve sharing pairs of electrons. That's the co part of the word, right? Covalent. So each involved atom contributes an electron to the sharing. whether it's polar or nonpolar. But as you might have experienced in real life, or in macroscopic life, not all sharing instances are fair sharing or equal sharing, right? Sometimes one party involved shares more than the other. And that can be true for covalent bonds. Now, this brings up a property of any given atom, which is called electronegativity. Electronegativity is how strongly a given atom wants or attracts its electrons to itself. If you let me anthropomorphize, give the atom human qualities, it's how greedy it is in terms of wanting that electron for itself. The higher the number for electronegativity, the more it wants to keep the electron by itself and not give it away. And the trend isn't perfect on the periodic table, but roughly, values for electronegativities are low in the lower left-hand corner of the periodic table, and then they get bigger as you go up to the right, upper right-hand corner, except for the noble gases. And so fluorine, right up there in the upper right-hand corner, is the highest, has the highest electronegativity value of any element. It really wants electrons for itself. Well, notice that oxygen is right next door to it. It also has a, compared to most things, a high electronegativity. Hydrogen, on the other hand, not nearly as high as oxygen. And keep in mind that hydrogen, despite being over there with the metals, is a non-metal. Okay? And remember also that we're talking about covalent bonds here. Covalent bonds occur between what kind of atoms? Between two non-metals, yes. So hydrogen and oxygen both qualify as non-metals in a water molecule. That's why it's a molecule. It's made up of non-metals covalently bonded together. Okay, now, the point here is that hydrogen is less greedy about its electron compared to oxygen because it has a lower electronegativity than oxygen does. So yes, they'll strike a deal about sharing, but oxygen is actually going to demand that that shared pair of electrons spend more time around the oxygen nucleus than the hydrogen nucleus. So it's an unequal sharing. All right? Well, think about what's being shared. Electrons, which are charged particles. Each electron carries a negative charge. And wherever those electrons are for more time than not is going to make that place a little bit negative, right? So that means in a bond between an oxygen and a hydrogen molecule, atom, which there are two of in a water molecule, right? There's two separate bonds here, two OH bonds. But in each single bond here between the oxygen and one of the hydrogens, the oxygen more strongly attracts the shared electrons, which therefore end up spending more time around that oxygen nucleus than they do around the hydrogen nucleus. And since the electrons are negative, that means the oxygen end of the bond is going to be slightly negative compared to the hydrogen end. And conversely, the hydrogen end is going to be slightly positive, because those electrons aren't there as often to counteract the positive charges of the proton that's in the hydrogen nucleus. Is that all clear? So in other words, unequal sharing in a covalent bond makes what we call a polar covalent bond. The word polar here refers to there being poles, two ends that are different in some respect. In this case, that respect is charge. There's a difference with respect to charge. It's not a full charge like ions are, right? In an ionic bond, the metal loses the electron by transferring it to the nonmetal, and That's a one-way transfer that's permanent. And that is a full charge that becomes put on, the negative charge gets put on to the nonmetal. The positive charge is left behind on the metal, right? So that is a full integer value of a charge. Here we don't have a full charge because those electrons are spending some time around the less electronegative species, which in this case would be the hydrogen. And we therefore give it a delta notation. This is a lowercase Greek delta, Greek D, version of a D. And the delta minus means partially negative, but not a full negative one. And delta positive means partially positive because of this. Exactly the same thing happens in the other bond because it's identical to the first bond. So the bonds individually are called polar covalent bonds in this case. And since water is an example that has these, we also say that the compound, water itself, or the molecule, is polar. Water is a polar compound. An individual water molecule is a polar molecule because it contains polar covalent bonds. And you wouldn't exist if it weren't for this fact. It causes a lot of importance in biology. We'll talk about that in a different chapter, though. Now to 16, we can see the consequence of this. On the top you have water. On the bottom you have ammonia. Now this is just an example. It could be two ammonia molecules, it could be two water molecules, or any other combination of polar molecules. The point here is that both ammonia and water are polar. And they are polar because they feature atoms that differ pretty drastically in their values of electronegativities. All right? And if you have that situation, then the bond between those two atoms that differ in their electronegativity values is going to be a polar bond, unequal sharing. So just like water has oxygen with electrons spending more time around it and therefore partially negative, ammonia has nitrogen, which has a higher electronegativity than hydrogen, doing the same thing, greedily wanting those electrons for itself. So the nitrogen end of each of these bonds is partially negative. Well, when you have two polar molecules in proximity to each other, whether the same kind, two waters or anything else, as long as they're both polar, then they don't ignore each other like nonpolar molecules do, because of these partial charges. So when they come close to each other, because of the attractive force between unlike charges, just like in an ionic bond, they will swivel when they get close to each other, kind of like magnets will move when you get close together, so that the negative end of one molecule will be close to the positive end of another molecule because of that attraction. And so in a population of polar molecules, this gives that population more order than it would in an equally big population of nonpolar molecules, which are just going to bounce off of each other and otherwise ignore each other. Okay? This is a bond because there is an attractive force here. But this, as I promised you, is an example of a bond that is not a chemical bond, because this is even weaker than an ionic bond, and it's not strong enough to keep these things together and form new stuff. A new compound is not being formed here. You still have ammonia and water remaining as those two compounds, but they're attracted to each other. This is called a hydrogen bond, simply because hydrogen is so often involved. Technically, hydrogen doesn't have to be involved. It could be any polar molecules attracted to each other, but usually, because there's hydrogen just about everywhere in molecules, usually hydrogen is involved. That's why it was called that. Okay? Any questions on that? 17. We looked at water, and we see it again in cartoon form here. and maybe you were wondering why it has a bent arrangement. In other words, why isn't water with oxygen in the middle and the hydrogens exactly on the opposite sides of each other? Well, this kind of tries to explain that. Remember, earlier today we looked at the oxygen, which had two paired orbitals, right? Those are the electrons that are staying part of oxygen. They're not being shared. And then we had two half-filled orbitals. Those are the ones that are involved in bonds. Four overall orbitals, though. The orbitals are trying to be as far apart from each other as possible. And geometrically, if you imagine that, if you have a center point and four other points that have to be as far apart from each other as possible, then that's going to form the four corners of a tetrahedron, which to you gaming nerds is the four-sided die. All right? If you move any of those corners, it's going to get it closer to another corner, right? So that maximally spaces them out. Well, in an oxygen molecule, it's in the center. I mean, in a water molecule, the oxygen is in the center. Two of those four corners on the tetrahedron are occupied by the unshared electrons. The other two corners are where the hydrogens are bonding, and that's why it's that bent arrangement. It's not a straight molecule. Does that make sense? Similarly for methane, I shouldn't say similarly, in methane, which is CH4, the carbon is in the middle. Remember, carbon has a valence of four, so it's making four bonds, in this case four single bonds, each with an individual hydrogen, and those hydrogens are at the four corners of the tetrahedron. Okay, now to 18. Another shift in gears. We're looking here at a couple examples of what are called signal molecules. Now, signal molecules are molecules that convey information. They cause things to happen in a cell that wouldn't happen without them, without the signal being present. And there are different... for a signal molecule, which is a signal in the form of a molecule rather than an electrical signal, for instance... One important thing to note about signal molecules is that no signal molecule has any effect on any cell unless and until that signal molecule binds to a receptor on the cell or in the cell. There has to be the binding of a signal to a receptor for anything to happen. If you think back to the example I gave you for positive feedback. What was that example?
Childbirth,
parturition, yes. Remember I said that oxytocin is released as a hormone? That's an example of a chemical signal. And almost all the body ignores it because it doesn't even know that oxytocin is there, since most cells in the body don't have the right kind of receptor for that molecule to bind to or fit into. The uterus does, though. So no chemical signal will have any effect unless it binds to a receptor of the right type. Receptors are proteins that have just the right type for a given kind of signal molecule. And the receptors are shown here in purple cartoon form. Those are membrane-bound proteins. They're part of a membrane. Right? They are tied to the membrane. And the signal molecule comes along and can bind to it because it's kind of a lock and key fit. It's just the right fit for shape-wise. Well, if the receptor isn't there, then this cell has no idea this signal molecule is there, is the point. That's one point. Of these two examples, which is endorphin and morphine, one of these, they're both signal molecules, but the endorphin is an example of an endogenous signal protein, I mean signal molecule. What does endo mean?
Out.
And gen, like in generation or genesis, means creation. So endogenous means created in within an organism. Endorphin is a signal molecule that we create in our bodies, in other words. There are also exogenous signal molecules, and we call those drugs. That's what drugs are. They are signal molecules that, if introduced into the body, bind to some sort of receptor and cause things to happen. Well, the major point, with given that background, is that it's not the entire signal molecule's shape that fits into the what is called the binding site of the receptor. Just like endorphin, which looks like a much more complicated molecule than morphine, and it is, but it's only this part that's in the box that actually is the business end of the signal, because that's the part that fits into the corresponding shape in the receptor molecule. And the reason that morphine can work and give us the same effects as naturally occurring endogenous endorphin is that it has part of it, the overall molecule, which is very similar to the part that fits in for endorphin. Right? The rest of this doesn't really matter to the cell, because all that has to happen is that the signal is binding to the receptor. This is an example, by the way, signals binding to receptors. The signals are examples of a more general word, which is called ligands. A ligand, well, to ligate means to tie or to bind. Like a ligature is a surgical ligature you tie. Ligand is a general word that means something that binds to a protein, at least temporarily. Signals do that. They have to in order to work. And there will be many other examples of this, that some of which we'll talk about. But the general consequence, whether it's a signal or not, any kind of ligand binding to a protein has the general consequence that the conformation or shape, that's just another name for the shape of the protein, the receptor protein, is going to change if that binding occurs. And this is how the cell knows that the signal is there. The change in the protein shape causes things to happen inside the cell that wouldn't without that shape change. All right? So keep that in mind about ligands binding, the binding of ligands causing conformational change. That is the chapter. Questions before I switch recordings?